we began in the beginning. I began in the beginning with a guy who was a sort of a second or third generation farmer, whereas I had no farming or gardening experience really at all, and nor did the other guy. So there was three men, one of whom had came from Alsace, and his father had been a grape farmer, and so he definitely had what you call a green thumb, and so together with him in the beginning, he was keen to have a large farm, growing a lot of produce, and so in the beginning we planted larger areas firstly with peanuts, but then there were the millets that the villagers were growing as well, because it's usually only the richer farmers who are growing peanuts, or the poorer ones who are prepared to gamble. But there are at least four millets that grow here, or five if you take kombu, ragi, varagu, and then the sort of inferior millets, I suppose you'd say samai and tanai, and they're in that order of size, really. And so you would normally what would normally happen here is that you'd have a dry summer when July came, the end, and in summer what the villagers would mostly do is to collect compost one way or other. They to associate with every house in the village is a pile of leaves and waste, and every drop of cow dung that they found, they would build up. So they got, by the end of summer, they've got a substantial pile of compost that in July they bring up and put on their fields, about 6 or 7 bullock cart loads to an acre, not very much. These are the old wooden wheeled bullock carts, about half the size of what we carry in one of these. And then as soon as it rained, then they would plough. Well, they would plough and spread compost. They would plough and then they would plough twice. They would plough, then spread compost and plough the compost in. And usually wait for the second rain to do a seeding ploughing, or plough or plant seed. And the first thing normally you would plant is kombu, which is the longest duration millet and the largest millet, but the least eaten, really. It's good chicken food, it's good cow food, but if you're personally eating it, it goes sour very fast, and so it's not easy to eat. They traditionally mixed it with ragi and made what they call kuru. And kuru, you only put a third of kombu, and these days very little kombu is grown anymore. Then there's ragi, they would vary year to year exactly what they grew, but generally they would begin with kombu. When the kombu harvest came in, which was 3.5 months, I think, then they would plant black gram, ulundu, and then that would go on. See, so you got that's August, September, October. You're planting ulundu in November, December. You harvested it in January, so you're harvesting black gram. You know these grains, ulundu? No. Charlie didn't mention these grains?
No, he didn't.
Oh, okay. Well, these are all the traditional grains that the villagers have been growing for. They originate, the millets all originate in Ethiopia. So they were, and the theory is that they were carried across by the farmers that came across here, and they gradually mutated to accommodate the latitude shift, you know. Anyhow, and then they would, but a farmer, so he would grow. He'll grow kombu, varagu, or ragi, these three major millets, as his first harvest. Then he would grow black gram, at least because he needs black gram. Their substantial diet here is idli and dosa, which requires a cereal and a dal, which is really their carbohydrate and protein. And they grow well together, like they would grow peanuts together with kombu, for instance, and they would often grow ulundu together, this black gram together with samai or with varagu, And so these two things, they grow well together, but they're also symbiotic when they were fermented together. When I don't know if you've ever seen, when your idlis and dosas, they depend very much on a very powerful fermentation, which comes about when these two things are put together. And so that was the substantial diet, and that was the substantial... The villagers, when they first came here, they ate very little rice, actually. They lived mostly on kuru, which was fermented ragi porridge. This is what they bought in their tiffins when they came for lunch, and they would eat that then with raw onion or with raw chili or just like that. As they bring it as a paste and make it into a porridge and then drink it. And it was a... And we still eat it at least once a day here because it's good energy food.
And all this was grown in a barren land,
Well, that was the thing it was barren up until monsoon. Mm. It was like absolute like a beach until monsoon. Then with the advent of the rain, then you would get weed seeds. And then they would plow and plant, and then they would have to weed and thin. They do a original weeding where you not only weed, but you thin your harvest too, to like a handspan between the plants sort of thing. And if you're lucky, you get away with just one weeding. If there's too much rain, then you got to do two weedings. And then, you know, then you've got you harvest by hand, and you have then to winnow, which means to separate the grain from the dirt, what they do with the wind, and then to grind it. So it's massively work intensive. Mm-hmm. And the village women are relieved really now to just eat rice because they grind it with an electric motor, and the women would spend most of their days grinding grain. And so we did the same. We working with village boys. I mean, the thing you've noticed is when you're working with young village men, they have the soil in their blood. Yeah. These guys, and they love to work with the soil. And we had, like for them, land is very precious. And there was an abundance of land when we came. You know, we were encouraged to take on as much land as we could, and we took on 100 acres around here. They said, like, please take more, you know, take the more you can look after, the better. And there was even money, we were given money to plant it, even though we were doing it very inefficiently.
You bought this land?
We didn't, no, we didn't buy any land.
Okay.
No, the land all belonged to, it had all been in trust to Oroville when we arrived. Mm. You see, we arrived and there was a situation where there was all this land, this plan for a city supposedly to be built, which included a green belt around the outside, and nobody living there. Mm. And so there was a major encouragement to do something on the land. And when I came, there was about 100 people already living on the land, already beginning to do things on the land, different isolated communities on the land. But we were actually the first forestation camp. So we're more a forestry community than we are an agricultural community. But at the same time, when you're working with young village men, they are so glad to work with the land, and they know so much about it to show their expertise, and also they, you know, they can bring you a ploughman and if you need compost and everything. And so that's basically what we did too. And so we then, for really since about 1973 until about quite recently, really, that I stopped growing crops because the peacocks. The peacocks, as soon as the peacocks were introduced into Oroville, or reintroduced into Oroville, presuming they were once here as a wild creatures, but when they were reintroduced here, they became a menace, really, because they're large birds. They were surrounded by forests by then, and they lived in the forest, and they would just hop over the fence and eat most of our harvest, you know, the peacocks. And so they put an end to our field crops. The villagers don't have the same problem with peacocks because they don't have a forest surrounding their fields. Like our fields are like clearings in a forest, you know, now that we've planted forests. And so And then what happened as I saw it to the villagers, and it all seemed to happen simultaneously almost, that there was, and this was, I would have thought in the end of the 70s, because when we first came there were isolated cashews growing, but there's also almost no cashews at all. There were cashews, a few small cashew orchards down by the village, and there was definitely a moment when, as far as I knew, the World Trade Organization shifted. There was an incentive to India, but I think it was Russia, shifted from buying almonds from Israel to buying cashews from India as a policy shift, you know.
Yeah, this is what I heard before.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Yeah, like the almonds were not available or really expensive.
That crop failed, and so there was suddenly an incentive, and then so then what happened here was the interesting thing about a monoculture is that if you take a large area and you plant it with a single species, that you have a sort of what you might call a honeymoon period before a pest gets organized, you know? And that's about 10 years. Mm-hmm. You get about 10 years. So, I mean, cashew is an extremely hardy crop. It will start providing you with nuts after about 3 years. It's not foraged by any animal. It's totally drought resistant. It's incredibly drought resistant. It's massively powerful and strong little plant, and I mean, it's not so bad for the soil really. It's a tree, and it's acidic, but it's and so there was an incentive in the beginning, I think, or maybe just in the elevated prices that they're able to sell their cashews for, but it very quickly became obvious to the villagers that if they shifted from a self-sufficient crop of growing millets to feed their family, they could shift it to cashews. They would have three rough years, you know, and what they would do is actually, what you do is you grow your millets between your cashew trees until your cashew trees are big enough, and so you're still getting a harvest. The harvest of one goes down as the other one comes up, you know.
Yeah. So before there was not so much income actually out of the crops.
No, nobody sold their crop before, you see, they ate it.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the thing, and you needed, it was the understanding was that you needed, I mean, a family that a family of, say, three or four or five children, probably they could get by on a single acre of... I mean, the Tamils are prepared to live on a very small amount of food, you know, unlike a lot of cultures. But even, like, I mean, I've been in Indonesia and Malaysia and these places, and they have much higher expectations of their farms than, say, Tamils do. Anyhow, the understanding was that you could feed your family from one, say, 2 acres of millets, and they're pretty skinny kids, and food's not very exciting, but that's how it is. But when you start growing cashews, you know, especially in the early days, by the time your trees are 5 years old, you're able to like quadruple or like four times or five times the income. And so what the impact of that in the long run was that the villagers realized, of course, I think every farmer really begrudges the amount of energy he has to put into his life, really. Like, they enjoy it, but it's such hard work that they don't really want to inflict it on their children, you know. I think it's as true of farmers anywhere in the world, that they like to liberate their children from I think it was Karl Marx that called the idiocy of farming. But I mean, that's the thing, it denies the dignity of hard work, but it does acknowledge the almost drudgery of farming that particularly depends on the vagaries of weather, you know. Anyhow, so what quickly became obvious to the farmers here is with cashews is that if they contracted their field out to somebody else, which would mean they lose maybe a quarter of their profit. They're still making two or three times the profit that they would have made had they were selling out. So they can still live a reasonably good life. They can begin to get their children educated, which means they don't have to have them out in the field there weeding and doing all this menial work in order just to make ends meet. And so it had a major impact on the social and economic map in the village, which was pretty impressive, you know, from this point of view, because you suddenly saw that it liberated women. You know, when you look at it now, because what happened with the cashews was that the price skyrocketed. And in fact, the price, even accounting for inflation, the price is going down every year. You know, like I think we have fields here that we originally contracted out for 40,000 rupees, and I think the last thing I got was 12. Mm. Although the trees have got bigger, there's more nuts. As you know, there's just that thing has peaked and now is going down. But what's happened in the peripherally is that the average family size here has dropped dramatically. Mm. You know, they've gone from average five to average two children or something now in one generation, you know. And you can see it here in the average age of this population has definitely shifted, because when we first came, you had people, young guys, coming all the time asking for work. Even I had a guy once with a degree in economics asking me for manual labor, you know, going, you know, what do you want? Can't you find it? And he said, no, there's no work. Mm-hmm. You know, but now there's nobody comes by. You can't even get laborers anymore, you know. And so what you start to see is the rice is now around here is all harvested by machinery. All the wood's cut with chainsaws. Like slowly, industrialization creeps in and replaces your workforce. You know.
Do you still have workforce from the early days walking around here?
Yeah, we do. They're beginning to begrudge. You see, because the thing is that their wages, their children are earning more than they are from early age, because their children are becoming craftsmen, becoming masons and carpenters and plumbers and painters and these sort of things, because there's such a large building industry in Oroville. And what they call tradesmen, their wages have skyrocketed, you know, because there's a high demand. Whereas menial labourers who some of them have been with me now for 30 years or something, their wages are sometimes half what their children's are, you know. I mean, and still it's not an unreasonable wage, but an agricultural wage traditionally is much lower than an industrial wage, so to speak, and so they've suffered. But meanwhile, you know, so what it means is you have lower families, you have smaller families, you have educated children, especially women now, because of the workforce. And you have emancipated women, really. You know, like the women finally don't have to sit behind a grinding stone day and night. They have an opportunity to have their own income, which gives them a chance to select who they're going to marry, really, and not be so ruled by this heavy-handed sort of family, dictatorship. And it's, you know, generally the village is generally a much more affluent and happier place than it was, you know. But and all we know, we haven't in any way been the agents of that situation. I still live very much like the villagers used to. You know, I've had villagers living with me, and they move out after a while because they say that I don't have refrigeration, and I don't have fans, and I don't have this, and I don't have that. That's as much better in the village than it is here. And we used to, you know, when they have a temple festival, where they have to have, in the temple festival, they have to have a little bit of all these old traditional grains, they come and ask me for them because they don't grow them anymore, you know. So it's the whole thing's gone full circle.
So the next step would be that the villagers realize that using chemicals and living a high-tech life is not everything what's worth it.
Yeah, well, yeah. You mean the luxury of the knowledge that we have? Yeah, well, that's it.
That's how Arofield started, actually.
Yeah, that's how I've always sort of seen it. You know, that even the luxury, you know, the luxury to be able to eat organic food is a, you know, like it doesn't interest villagers really, because Their priorities are much higher than that. You know, they don't have the luxury of being able to, often even to be able to consider, you know, what they do with their time.
Yeah. And when did you saw this change especially happen? What time was this?
It's happened over the last. Well, see, it's happened. You know, over the last really 30 years. You know, I mean, could say that it began to happen the end of the 70s, and you know, the other thing I think that probably Charlie mentioned was that because we were planting forests around the villages, and the predominant timber species in our forest is this Australian acacia, the auriculiformis, what we call the work tree. It migrates. It's one of the few pioneer species that we planted here that actually does proliferate.
Yeah, it's a tree who doesn't need so much water and.
Yeah, well, the Australian. If you notice, the Australian species, the casuarina, the eucalyptus and the work tree, they're all Australian species. And the Australian soils are by far the most depleted on the planet.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, by far. And because you'd normally rate soils by layering of the soil sort of thing. And Australia is off the... It's off the sort of freak lines, you know, and it's been a long time since there's been any volcanic activity in Australia. And then the reason that the Australian Aborigine actually has never really established a civilization there was that it's extremely poor soils, there were no domesticable plants, there were no domesticable animals. And so they just remained as a hunter gatherer. They never even developed an architecture. You know, they never even developed a written language. You know, they had no reason to.
No.
They reached an optimal level, a population level, I think of 500,000 or something. After about the first 10,000 years they're there, considering they've been there for 30,000 to 50,000 years. And then nothing shifted. They just lived this a balanced life with the environment ever since, you know, until of course they were crudely colonized.
Yeah. So these trees were especially useful by transforming this barren land into the forest it is now.
Well, they were, yeah. The point is, though, that they were migrating from our forest into the village fields, you know. And so what the villagers, in the beginning, they didn't really know what to make of them. And they were cutting them down for firewood when they were quite small. But then they started to notice that actually the longer you leave them, because they're also the Australian species are short lifetime. Mm-hmm. They normally don't live more than, I mean, the eucalypts can live up to 100 years, but you never have these sort of 1,000-year-old trees and stuff in Australia, you know. But the work tree itself, the acacia, it's only got a 15 to 20-year lifespan. And so if you leave it, for that span, because if you look at the cross section through a work tree, you have a heartwood, and you can tell pretty well the age of the tree by the not just by the size, but by the thickness of the living wood, which is the white wood that surrounds it. And as it gets older, that shrinks and shrinks until you have a very small, like a centimeter left of white wood, and the rest is heartwood. And so, at this point, if these trees then they die naturally in the ground, you leave them standing for about a year. And they season naturally, you know. They just dry out, and then you can cut them down. And so they're a powerful resource. They're very good. The offcuts are very good firewood, and the wood itself, like all the wood that you can see here, all the wood, the carpentry wood, all the wood framing in the windows and the doors and all those houses and everything, all that wood, that's all the same wood. It's either, I mean, some of that is eucalyptus, but most of it is the work tree. This is the same species of wood, because it's actually a viable carpentry wood.
Yeah.
And then the villagers started to realize that it is a resource, and they still mostly don't have the patience to leave it till it's fully grown. I mean, you see these bullock cart loads of work tree going down the road all the time, and you can see through the cross section of the log often how green they are, you know, that they haven't waited to get the full benefit of the work, but they will slowly realize that, you know. And but if you go down in the village outside almost every house, there's two or three logs just sitting there, you know, that they're sort of holding on to. It's like they're gold. But so it's definitely, and you know, when we came, you had to go all the way to Pondicherry to find a sawmill, you know, where you saw up logs of wood. And now there's one in Quillapalium. There's one down the bottom of the road. There's two down the bottom of the road. You know, there's sawmills, and in order for a sawmill to function, it has to pretty well be cutting wood for at least 8 hours a day, solid, continuous, or it loses money.
So actually, next to cashew crops, the villagers also started to do forestry.
Well, slowly, yeah. Well, it's forestry, I suppose you could say. It was woodlot forestry, you know, which is just growing wood, carpentry wood. But yeah, they've slowly learnt when we first came here and were planting trees, the villagers we were working with were saying, but what do you want to plant trees for? You know, it's they don't make food. No. Sort of thing. They didn't see wood as an intrinsically valuable resource.
No, and also not as an important aspect for creating healthy soil.
No, that wasn't part of their understanding, you know.
Did that change?
I don't know. I don't think philosophically they're not going to have any sort of organic awakening, I don't think. Not soon. That comes with affluence and education, really. Yeah. But there's certainly, I mean, you very much grow to respect what the villagers do with what they've got, you know. You know, you always think, oh, we can improve this, or we can, you know, we have the arrogance of thinking that we come with a solution to other people's problems, you know. But actually, they have the solutions to our problems, you know, and it's as true of architecture in Auroville as it is of anything, you know, that if we look closely, because the villagers are very skilled at living together, really, you know. And
can you give an example?
What of?
Yeah, of what we can learn from the villagers.
I don't know. I mean, we learned how to. When I first came, I learned how to fish from the villagers when I was living on the beach, and I started with somebody who thought they knew how to fish, and in the end, the only way we were going to catch fish was to learn from the villagers how to fish. We've learned agriculture from the villagers. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have in the village, even if you look at the organization of the village, they have a general meeting of the elders of the village every month on the dark moon when people are the least excited, sort of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So they've learned from experience that you don't just gather together an excitable crowd every time something goes wrong, you know. They, as far as I'm concerned, they've learned how to dress, they've learned how to eat, and they've learned how to survive. And it's, I mean, they're certainly now they've been totally confused by white rice, and you know, the cashew in nutritional terms hasn't been an asset, you know, because they now live predominantly on white rice, which just doesn't have the sustaining, especially if it's as highly polished as they polish it. It just doesn't have the same sustaining nutritional value, you know, as say the ragi did that they used to eat when they first came.
And in these years, how did your own farm develop? So you told us that you start.
So what we've done is shifted really from field crops to orchards. So also with the weather pattern changing like that, when you've got an irregular weather pattern, you're much better off growing trees, fruit trees, because they're much more resilient, you know, with a field crop. They're totally susceptible to 2 weeks without rain, and you lose the lot, sort of thing, you know. And you see with mangoes, with all these fruit trees that we grow, so we grow maybe five different types of fruit trees, you know.
Do you use irrigation?
No. We watered fruit trees for the first 3 years of their life, usually, and then after that they're established.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't. I mean, if you irrigate, you'll definitely increase your fruit production, but you'll also massively increase your costs. You know, so you reach a sort of a point. So we're actually much more of a subsistence farm, really. Like we grow what we can and eat most of what we grow ourselves. You know.
Mm.
And so we at this time of the year we can grow quite a lot of vegetables. We try and grow things like pumpkins because they can be stored and last through summer. And we don't grow really any grains anymore at all. We grow a lot of fruit and a sustaining amount of vegetables is what we've got down to now. And we use sprinkler systems in the vegetable garden. You know, I have a sprinkler system connected to the overflow from the tanks. So whenever our tanks are full, then you open your sprinkler system irrespective of the time of day or night and water your fields. And you get, I mean, of course we depend on both wind and sun for our water. We have a windmill and we have a solar-powered pump. All through summer we have no water problem at all. I mean, we do have a water problem in monsoon because you get no wind or sun during monsoon, but then you've got rain.
Yeah.
But I mean, you have trouble with drinking, cooking and washing water really in monsoon, but we're slowly overcoming that with the catchment, rain catchment, and you know.
Yeah. How many acres of fruit trees do you have at the moment?
About three.
Only 3 acres. Yeah. And you had 100 acres when you started.
We were trying to farm 100 acres, yeah, but that included a lot of peripheral farms. And it included bits of Ora Green, it included Nilatungam, it included Dana, it even included part of Transformation. And so bit by bit, those communities have all started off on our old farmland.
Mm-hmm.
And we've pretty well got back to just being, gardeners.
Yeah, exactly. And do you have a view on the future of farming in Oudeviel, where it should head to? I know they're busy with a 5-year plan. Do you have your own vision on this?
Well, I don't know. I think we the mistake we make in Oroville is this sort of zoning attitude. You know, so when you have a cultural zone and a residential zone and an industrial zone and a sort of a green belt, which is basically your agricultural zone, it's like you tend, if you've got an educational zone, you tend to think that education goes on only in the educational zone and not in the home, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas,
it's actually pretty modernistic in a way. Like, it's how cities nowadays are structured with these different zones.
Well, it is, but it's actually, well, I wouldn't say it was modernistic. I'd say it was more anachronistic, really, that because the future that I imagine surviving in Oroville, see, if you've got an industrial zone that's restricted to industry, it becomes a soulless and empty and dangerous place at night, you know.
That's what's happening at the moment all over the world.
Yeah. Whereas if you realize that within an industrial zone, a few little farms, some housing, some sort of a few shops, a cafe, a few things to give life to it, and that's what is actually happening in Oroville.
Mm-hmm.
That we're not heavily hammering the zoning sort of thing, because I was trained as an architect and town planner, and zoning is in fact a very restrictive concept that most town planners don't, you know. I mean, the organic approach to town planning in Oroville would be to see what is happening and to help it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Not to try to channel it in any way, but to allow it to happen. You know, it's like if you've got a small Chinatown that springs up in your city, the best thing you can do is to encourage it, you know, because it's going to become a cultural asset, you know. Like, for instance, we've got a youth centre just here around the corner. Now, the youth because they have their own center, they put a lot of energy into making that into a vibrant place, you know, and that is something which is completely, and the community is constantly saying, oh, no, they're in the wrong place, you know. But the thing, if you're going to take a group of people and try to make them do what you want to do, you're going to completely kill their initiative, you know. And so it's happened agriculturally, you know, that Oroville in the beginning, the whole of Oroville in the beginning was a farm. And everybody felt a responsibility to growing food. And I see this happens, for instance, I was in England 2 years ago when there was this fuel crisis suddenly, you know, and I see what happens in a country like that. I mean, the English are famous gardeners anyhow. I mean, you know, but the Australians aren't, for example, you know. Australians don't automatically, they grow, my father grew a few tomatoes and things in his yard, but they don't, you know, when you got an Italian, for instance, who moved in next door, man, they had grapes growing over their trellises and olives growing in their yard, and, you know, the most amazing amount of food growing on this small piece of land. You can see these people came from a very powerful food in imperative. And I could see it in England too, when the minute there was this fuel crisis and it started to be a shortage of all sorts of things, then people just immediately started digging up their lawn and planting food and planting garden, you know, suddenly realized that the land could also produce them with food. And like Krishna from Solitude is over here the other day, and he's trying now to convince them at the town hall to start growing food in front of the town hall, between the town hall and more as a token gesture really than anything else, you know. But like Aspiration, for instance, community, which is now as a community, it's pretty sleepy. You know, it's a commuting community. If you go down there any time of the day, there's a lot of wives sweeping the houses, but everyone's gone off to work, basically, you know. And when Aspiration Community, when it began, was a very vibrant farming community. There was a dairy there. There were people keeping chickens there. They used to get together every weekend and work the gardens and things there, you know. And that was a majorly powerful collective thing. And the only thing that's going to, I think, is going to make that come back to Oroville is going to be a shortage of food. But you can see when, for instance, the prices of onions now got up to 100 rupees a kilo this year, you know, and they can see that there's definitely food shortages are definitely going to impact on Oroville. And so the more you personally know about growing food, the more in a situation like Oroville, you know, if you're living in a big city and you're totally dependent on food that's coming from outside, then you've got to start growing things in your window boxes and you know. And
so the best solution for sustainable Oroville is actually to encourage people to grow their own food.
Absolutely.
In all sort of places.
Yeah, everybody, I think, to take advantage. Well, it's also, you know, it's like this thing of the alternative lifestyle. The more you depend on a windmill, and the more you depend on a solar panel, and the more you deal with your own waste, and the more you take responsibility for your own resources and wastes, the more involved you are. You know, when the wind blows like this, I know that this is pumping me water. So the wind is a celebration of you know. When the sun is out, I know that it's charging the batteries and that it's pumping the water. You know. It's a whole thing is a total involvement with the environment that we've lost in many instances, you know, and so it's the same with food, you know. When you start growing your own food, like we today, we ate the first pumpkin from our garden, and man, we sat down and said, wow, you know, such a delicious pumpkin. But it's yeah, I think the more we, as a, you know, that take responsibility, and there are within Oroville. I mean, the thing is that there are natural gardeners, you know, and there are people that you see who, no matter how they live, they grow food, you know, even the little pot plants and stuff. They're growing tomatoes and in plastic bags and anything, you know, in order to grow some food for the pleasure of growing it and for the satisfaction of eating it. But you know, I think it's something, it's a skill that I'm constantly trying to encourage children. See, children aren't encouraged to grow food. They're encouraged to become bloody zombies, you know. And depend upon, you know. So we've got to a point now where people think, oh, food all grows in the farms, education goes on in the schools, you know,
yeah.
Industry, you know, culture goes on in the cultural zone, and so you exempt yourself from any need to be involved in anything in the end because you don't, you know, it's all been sort of categorized, and so I don't know. I personally think that you know, but I think it will take a crisis, you know, like the oil crisis in England. To get people to realise that I mean, the only thing, you know, the only sort of encouragement you can say is, okay, you know, people like Krishna and Stefan and, you know, and Thomas and Bernard and all these guys, these really fanatical farmers, you know, they are doing so much to try to encourage other people in the community to start growing food and to, you know, they're supplying seeds and information and seedlings and, you know, and Krishna now has this basket system and stuff going. It's definitely, we've just got to unhook ourselves. You know, when you realise that, you know, when I was growing all these different grains, I couldn't find anybody in Oroville who would buy them, you know.
Because they all wanted...
all eating pasta and, yeah. I mean, then it was bread and something else, but now... I mean, the diet of the average Oroville child is pasta and pizza now.
So it's not local.
No, it's party food. Well, nobody grows wheat. There's no wheat grown south of the Punjab, you know. Mm. And a lot of the wheat that India gets is imported from places like Australia. So it's heavily pesticided and you know, sterilized. And anyhow, that's, you know, I don't want to be too critical, but...
There's still some work to do.
Yeah. That's how you can see it, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Do you have anything else to add which we didn't discuss, another topic or...
Oh, tons of things, maybe, but there's another interview.
Yeah, okay. Now we meet again.
Yeah.